You are listening to Bigfoot, Ground Zero. All right, you are listening to Bigfoot Ground Zero. My name is Dave. It is April 2nd, 2016. I'm really excited about this show tonight. We have Dr. Bindernagel on. I was fortunate to grab an interview with him a couple of months ago. I've just now been able to put it up, but for those of you who are new to the whole Bigfoot thing, just go to Google and type in Dr. Bindernagel. You will find a plethora of television shows he's been on, documentaries. He is an author many times over. As close as you can get to an expert on the topic of Sasquatch. And again, we don't have a body, so I love the fact that he has such a pragmatic approach to searching for this elusive creature, whatever you call it. And you're going to hear from a guy who is not only extremely knowledgeable, but if you really look into what he's doing and who he is during this interview, you will notice definitely a certain intensity about what he's doing. And he readily admits, I mean, here's a guy that has been researching Sasquatch for many years and a guy who has had a great career as a wildlife biologist. He's been around the world, plying his trade, studying, and doing it right. But he's at an age in his life where he definitely knows that he's not going to be able to do this forever. And he knows his time in the field is limited. And you can hear it in his voice. You can hear it in his demeanor. And he is really frustrated as well with his scientific colleagues who won't give the topic the time of day. And we all share that frustration. I know, right? It's like, I don't know, you're sitting at the bar next to somebody talking about it, or you're sitting to somebody who's, you know, whatever profession, wherever you are. But can you imagine being really in the scientific field, really well-trained, really well-educated, and you've come to the conclusion that these things probably exist, and all we need to do is do some further research, get the scientific community behind it, actually do weeks and weeks and months of study and blanket the forest, and we'll find the answer. But it's not happening. And you can hear it in his voice. And I just want to say, Dr. Bindernagel, thank you for taking the opportunity, actually taking the time to give me the opportunity to reach out to you and have this conversation. It was a pleasure. And I know you've extended the invite to do this again, and we definitely will. But I also share your urgency, and I hope that, you know, one day the scientific community, and when these things are discovered, that your research will be vindicated and that it will be recognized for being truly at the forefront. So anyway, we won't hold it up any longer. Let's go to the interview with Dr. Bindernagel, and I will talk to you on the other side.
All right, so as promised, we are here with Dr. Bindernagel. Dr. Bindernagel, your reputation precedes you, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Well, thanks very much, David.
I want to cover off on a couple of things in this interview. Kind of one, what you've done during your career, some of the highlights of your career. I want to talk about what you think a successful expedition or time spent in the field researching Sasquatch looks like, and perhaps getting into some of, if you can, without giving away trade secrets. I know that it's kind of always an interesting thing in that regard, but kind of going into what you kind of have learned and what you might employ in the future. And I know you're doing some research right now that we can talk about at some point, but let me take a step back, and I'm always interested to know, and I know my listeners are too, What got you started in the whole, well, what got you started in wildlife biology? What was the interest there? And then what was the interest in Sasquatch?
Okay. Gee, that's a lot of ground to cover, David, but thanks. And when you mentioned career, I thought we were going to go back to my – I had a career as an international wildlife biologist, and I thought it was a reasonably successful career, you know, working in Africa, working with the United Nations. But it's true that I kind of coming back to British Columbia here and working as a consulting biologist, but I did put that aside to take on Sasquatch research some years ago, like full time. So anyway.
So my question is, you know, where did that start passion wise? You and I had spoken, you know, off the record, kind of talking about a couple of things, but you shared the exact experience of what had happened to launch you down the road of finding the truth about these creatures and their existence. What was that? Because I found that really interesting.
Oh, well, good. Well, there were two things. The first goes way back to, 1963, when I'm still in university, third year undergraduate student. I'm in a wildlife management course, one of the first actually in North America, so it was great, but we're still just talking about moose and elk. And I mentioned this article from Argosy magazine about the so-called wild man in British Columbia. And the professor, and I asked, what about this? And the professor said, we can't possibly take time to talk about things like that. And so we went back to moose, deer, and elk, and my, you know, classmates poked fun at me. Ha ha, that's what you get for bringing up something really silly. It didn't sound silly. This was an article by Ivan Sanderson, who was a reputed zoologist, and it got my back up, because when you're, probably 22 years old then?
Sure.
And new in science, and I thought, gee, aren't we somewhat idealistic about and open-minded? Well, apparently not. So that was the start, and it followed along. And then the next stage was when I was working in the international community of wildlife biologists in East Africa, when I raised it with colleagues there amongst Europeans and Americans, and they took it much more seriously. They said, well, John, if I were you and I was going back to Canada, I'd look at this and this and this, and especially food habits, which I did from 1975 onward.
And so why do you think they were much more open-minded? Is it the education system there? Is it the way they look at it? What do you think that is?
Well, that's a really good question, and I go through it from time to – well, not time to time. I go through it daily because I'm dealing with this. I don't want to use the word closed-mindedness with regard to my scientific colleagues, but what I am dealing with is a very – pronounced unwillingness of my scientific colleagues to scrutinize the evidence. I'm not saying unwillingness to accept the evidence. I'm just saying, gee, we can't even bring this evidence to their attention in scientific conferences and papers. So I'll go on here a little bit. So the problem for me is not whether or not the Sasquatch exists, because I'm pretty much convinced of that, but why has it remained scientifically taboo?
Right. You know, it's funny. A couple of episodes ago, Carl and I were talking about that, and it almost takes somebody, you know, such as yourself, who almost says, you know what, I believe what I believe based on what I've seen and the evidence I've found. I think these things exist. And when a discovery is made, people like you will be vindicated. But you're right, it's just breaking through, and you need one or two or three other people, your colleagues or your peers in your field to back you. And then when the discovery is made, you know, then it's a whole new ball game. So let me ask you this then about that. Who are the types of people that, and where I'm coming from is this, you know, there's different characteristics of sightings, there's different, you know, types of people that have sightings, there's various people that bring different observations to the table. In your field of work, as you gather people who are also people who are studying the topic, what's the worst personality trait that these folks tend to have?
I try to stay away from that, but I am very supportive of the amateur investigators because they are doing the job that we credentialed scientists are. It's our responsibility. It's our professional responsibility. I may not be paid to do this, but
right.
many of my colleagues are paid to provide informed comment to the public. And this is what's really bugging me. And it's why I'm now considering building a small portable soapbox to take to conferences so I can actually stand on this soapbox and say, and the conferences, of course, are all amateurs, you know.
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
You get Jeff Meldrum and myself and a couple of others, at the professional scientific level, but very few of us. And I think, well, first of all, I think my scientific colleagues are really missing something important from their own right, but they're also being very unprofessional. And that's what I want to say from a soapbox, because I'm really getting tired of them being so smug and so self-righteous by ignoring the, I mean, it's not just they find the evidence unsatisfactory. They dismiss it out of hand without scrutiny. So pardon me. I obviously I'm standing on, metaphorically, on the soapbox.
No, that's
right
okay.
Now.
No, I love it. I love it. And how do you sit across the table? Maybe you're having dinner or lunch with a colleague, and they just look at you and they say, listen, John.
I don't. Okay. I don't anymore. I used to. I moved out to British Columbia after my work in Africa and you know, come out here to study this thing. I said, gee, there's all this evidence in British Columbia. It obviously is one of the best places on the planet, you know, right along
sure.
with Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Northern California. There is no conversation going on. I had
right.
to hide my interest if I was going to remain professionally employable. And,
yeah.
well, I mean, which might have been okay in 1975 when we arrived here. But by now, I'm still trying to get this onto the agenda of some conferences, and I'm still being, I'm not being rebuffed. I'm being absolutely dismissed. I don't think the subject is being considered. And I think,
yeah,
oh, shucks, I'm actually trying to help my scientific colleagues. I'm not trying to draw attention to myself. I'm saying, gee, it's too late to look proactive, but we don't have to look as if we have our head in the sand.
Look at that angle. We love citing stories, but I'm more interested in what we're doing to actually advance the cause and advance the research in the topic itself. Here's the thing. Here's the disconnect that I have. As a wildlife biologist, and your peers that are out there and people you know, and I'm sure they rib you and, you know, joke with you about the whole Bigfoot thing. You know, hunters will tell you if they're not even a hunter. If you're looking at the ground and you see deer tracks, it's a deer. If you see moose tracks, it's a moose. If you see bear tracks, well, you have a bear. Why does it all of a sudden become not an animal when we find verifiable huge footprints with thermal ridges and scarring and that sort of thing? Suddenly it's an animal that doesn't exist. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's the question I addressed in the second book. You know, I wrote the first book, 1998, what's that, over 15 years ago, saying, you know,
sure.
describing the anatomy and behavior and some of the ecology of the Sasquatch. Zero reviews from my, you know, from scientific journals, zero comments. And then I discovered a few years later, it came to me, John, you've been trying to discuss the anatomy and behavior of a mammal, a North American mammal, not yet considered to have been discovered. So let's look at the discovery process. And that's where I still am. I spent 7 years on the second book. It was fascinating. I mean, scientists really do resist discoveries which seem to come somehow, well, in their eyes, out of the blue without a whole lot of steps or links leading up to them. And that's what this appears. Suddenly there are these tracks found in California in 1958. Suddenly there's the Patterson-Gimlin film in 67. And they're saying, what? No, we can't be unaware of this.
Right.
Well, we have been unaware of it, and for some reason we've chosen to remain unaware of it. And that's why I spend so much of my time kind of looking back, like at the historical record. Gee whiz, there were a lot of heads-ups in the historical record. And we go back further to the First Nations people, early Americans and Aboriginal people in Canada. They've been telling us, but we've misinterpreted that.
Right.
And now we've had the recent accounts, and we've chosen to dismiss them as hallucinations or hunters coming home from the pub or stuff. And I think, oh, shucks, you know.
Right.
So we continued, you know, to document the tracks and photographs and casts, and we accumulate the evidence. We try to bring it forward at professional conferences, but we get very few opportunities for that. And to me, the situation is absolutely bizarre. And one day we will look back and well, I hope my colleagues will have the hope they'll be embarrassed. They should be, but anyway.
No. I completely get that. And I think some of the, you know, I don't have a background, biology background or wildlife biology background, but I feel like some of the discoveries or ways we approach problems are done when somebody has a creative burst of ideas, something that's outside the box, you know, something that, you know, I mean, crazy things like, you know, you're talking about trail cams and, you know, can these things see them? Well, what if you deploy, you know, trail cams on tripods and you just walk and drop them as you go. And there's certain areas so you can kind of move these things around and get different, you know, views. I like to think a little bit outside of the box. And I guess I'm framing this question to you is there anything you can think of that creatively that would support scientific methodology that we could be doing, that you're employing maybe in research that you're doing now that you haven't done 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, my colleagues are waiting for the type specimen, the road-killed Sasquatch, maybe the hunter-killed Sasquatch, you know, but something that provides the cadaver, you know, the body,
right.
Okay, and then,
right.
Then there's something to examine. Sure, sure, well, obviously, that'll just, you know, bring us, you know, suddenly overnight, it'll be accepted.
Sure.
My point is, in advance of that, can we not discuss the evidence which is pointing to that conclusion? You know, a conclusion which will probably happen at some point. And,
sure.
Yeah, anyway, so as you know, talking about various forms of evidence, and I review my books and in my lectures, and as I work away here, you know, all the eyewitness descriptions, eyewitness drawings, certainly the Patterson-Gimlin film. But for me, this collection of tracks documented as plaster casts, and you know, as you know, Jeff Meldrum there at Idaho State University's got
over
200 by now. And
right.
And I've moved on to kind of the vocalizations, which we happen to have happening quite nearby, well, relatively nearby where I am right now. And, you know, this is analyzable evidence that can be scrutinized and say, okay, this is not a bear, this is not a human, so we're still in that area of something not yet explained, but at least we're getting more evidence.
That, you know what? Now I have to transition to, because I believe footprints are the telltale sign as well. I mean, you've got thousands and thousands, and yeah, I don't know who said this, who was the person that said this, and if I'm misquoting somebody or not quoting, I apologize. But, you know, if just one footprint is right, then Sasquatch exists. And
yeah. Well, that was John Green. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
Right.
Okay, so I can remember things, but not all of it. What does it say? What do you say? It's I'm a master of all things that are insignificant, saying wise. I have all these things in my head. But what I wanted to talk to you about now is kind of what you're doing. I know you're working on a project, and I don't know how in-depth you want to get into it. I did see the news report. But can you give us the whole thing? Because what I'd like to do, with your permission, is after this, send the link out for the news anchor that interviewed you for the program, and then, you know, played the vocal sounds and that sort of thing. If I could do that. But right now, just kind of explain what you're doing and what you found, and kind of why you're excited about it.
Well, I'm a, first of all, you probably have the sense already that I'm 74 years old. I'm running out of time.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound desperate, but I'm getting desperate. I'm getting desperate to get my scientific colleagues on side. I'm trying to save their bacon. I want them to look as if they've given, you know, sort of due diligence to this subject. And they continue to be so darn obstinate. Anyway, so this is a new area for me, vocalizations. I mean, I'm a guy who's half deaf. I wrecked my hearing as a young man shooting, and now I'm wearing hearing aids and all that.
Sure.
Anyway, but so here I am working up in this village, Alert Bay, on the BC coast, and people are hearing these vocalizations, those who are up at night or maybe working on computers and the night owls, and they open the window and say, and then you get these reports, oh my goodness, I heard it again last night. It sounded like there were two of them calling back and forth. It was really loud, and it went on for almost 10 minutes. And I go up there and hear this, and I go nuts because I say, gee, didn't anyone think to try to record it on their cell phone? I mean, I'm not a cell phone user, but I know just on video you get a decent recording. And with an iPhone, if you go to, I don't know what the utility app is, something like Voice Memo, you get some really good quality recordings. So there are a couple of those, enough to keep it going. And I'm up there setting out, not high-end, but reasonable sound recorders overnight, and now here I am at home reviewing them. But what really bugs me is that these folks don't know that recording those vocalizations would be a real contribution to scientific research.
Right.
And I can't help but fault my colleagues for having failed to prevent informed comment over the years, where we would now be saying, gee, good for you guys. The more recordings you get, the more data we have to review. We can do spectrograms. We can differentiate these vocalizations from bears and wolves and dogs howling and all that. But we're not there. And this is what, 2015?
Yeah, there's people that are using the spectrograph, but you're right. It's not your colleagues of the scientific community that are taking it seriously enough to do sound comparisons, because, yeah, you're right. There would be a lot more anomalies to note than that are being noted now.
Yeah, the folks doing the spectrograms are these dedicated amateurs, David Ellis in Washington, Paul Graves in Washington State. I mean, scientists – oh, sorry – I have to stop doing this, but no, we're very dependent on the dedicated amateurs, because this is their thing. They're filling in the vacuum which we scientists have left. We have chosen to leave it. We have said, thanks, but no thanks. You know, and nothing to do with this unfolding discovery. It may be the discovery of two centuries, but for some reason we feel everything is bogus, and we're just not going to. It's just amazing. Sorry, I keep going back onto the same thing, and I'll try to stop doing this.
Listen, you know, you've had years of years of frustration with that. Let me ask you a personal question, because I think this is important, because I always believe that it gets to the root of what drives people. Would you rather be recognized at some point as somebody who led the way in research and have your findings vindicated, or see a Sasquatch if you couldn't have both?
Well, thanks very much. I almost have given up on as far as being recognized. I mean, gee, we had John Green, we had Grover Krantz, we had Richard Greenwell. We had a number of very serious investigators almost forgotten. And we'll go back to them. We already acknowledge Grover Krantz, and that's good.
Sure. Oh,
John
yeah.
Green is still alive, but almost forgotten. And, I mean, these were the pioneers, and we're building on their shoulders. And I'm just, you know, the only thing that makes me, if I am noted, it's because I happen to have this PhD and I happen to have this background in, you know, as a professional wildlife biologist. So it helps. It helps with my credibility. Well, with some groups, not much
sure.
with my colleagues here in BC. But anyway, no, as far as seeing a Sasquatch, I had a very observation back back east. I don't know if people want to. Someone had a project going there. Well, Adrian Erickson had a project going there and invited me there, and I'm sure I saw a Sasquatch, but it wasn't a great sighting. You know, the important thing for me is vindicating the people who brought forward the reports and brought forward this great track evidence. That's the stuff
right.
that really impresses me.
Now,
trying to affirm their contribution because, gee whiz, you know, if there's any progress being made, and there is,
right.
it's because of, you know, hunters and naturalists and hikers saying, gee, I've seen this thing, and it was, you know, like a track that's no bear, and, you know, anyway.
Well, I've got a friend of mine in New Hampshire. He lives in Maine now, but he was visiting a friend's mother in New Hampshire, and it was a dog that just started yapping at something up this hill, and the hill was maybe 75, 100 feet up, not very high. He could see the ridge of it, and he said something was walking across it, furry like a bear, but walking, and it wasn't doing the circus dance like a bear does when it tries to walk. He said, this gave me the chills. I had to go. I saw this thing walking across this hill. I know it wasn't a bear. And there's people like that who they've got no reason to lie. He's never come forward with a sighting. He's talked to me and a couple other people. Those are the credible sightings that make me go, yeah, there's something here. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, there's so many of those, and I feel so badly for those people because by now they should be being supported. You know, there should be
right.
this. Well, there is the BFRO database, but there should be a scientific database. There should be, was it Massachusetts? You know, Fish and Wildlife biologists should be out there saying, gee, thanks very much for your report. Can we talk to you and get the details? Can you show us where it was? I don't know if it's happening back there. I doubt it. It's sure not happening here. And in a way, it seems to be harder for people in the Midwest and back east and like in central Canada, because if the Sasquatch is considered to exist, they'll say, well, maybe in the Pacific Northwest with all that stuff. No. The early reports are all from the east. You know, it started in the east, and as people moved west, they kept encountering them. So once we get into the historical report, we found there was a very natural progression of Sasquatches being observed in Arkansas and Tennessee and those places,
sure.
and Georgia even, and then coming out here more so. But, you know, we do this thing. We say, no, it can't be in this state because it's too developed, like Ohio. People used to object to Ohio. Gee, Ohio has a lot of reports. But BC maybe. Oh, well, yeah, BC's good, definitely, but nothing wrong with Ohio, nothing wrong with Massachusetts.
No, it's just, it's interesting. Well, and you don't know, you know, maybe different spinoffs of the species and who lives where. I mean, it's like brown bears and black bears live in different areas, and a lot of it's climate dependent. And so you don't know, but yeah, I mean, the sightings are coming from all parts of the country. And the research that I do here now, I go out to the woods the best I can, and you know, I go to places where there were sightings, but you would be surprised if you simply typed in Bigfoot sighting and then a town somewhere in whatever state in the Northeast, Maine, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, you would be surprised at the number of sightings. And I'm just finding people, and it's weird because I'll go to a town and I'll, you know, do some research and talk to people, and somebody will come out of the woodwork. When they hear that I'm doing that, they'll come out of the woodwork and say, listen, I don't really want to go on your show or anything, but I want to tell you what happened to me in 1982. And they're, you know, I have an intel background, naval intelligence background, and one of the training subject matter that I had was kind of reading people, knowing signs on if they're being forthright about what they're saying, and, you know, little, and these people, their tells, they don't have any. They look you right in the eye. They don't blink. The palms are open. They've got nothing to hide. And it's it's amazing. I share your frustration. I share your frustration because these people should
well,
be.
See, I share the frustration of those people. You know, I mean, their reports, they shouldn't have to hide them. They shouldn't have to say to you, don't use my name, don't tell anyone where I'm from. Oh, gee, we should be so far beyond that. And I
know.
Guess that's what that, I find it sad. I find it very sad.
Yeah, no, it is. Well,
sorry.
As long as you've been doing this, it's got to be like, really, it's like none of this matters. It's like as you get older in life, you realize what's important and what's not. It's like, okay, these people should not be put through the ringer or made to feel like they're crazy, you know?
Yeah. Thanks for the opportunity, David, to speak because, you know, yeah, I think it's very important. And I mean, I'm sitting here in this old house in this small town on Vancouver Island. I'm pretty much out of the loop. And I said, am I, you know, and this is the thing, am I delusional? Why am I going on about this when the rest of, you know, my professional society of biologists in BC don't want to hear about it? You know, the national Wildlife Society certainly doesn't want to hear about it. You know, I send out these review copies of my books, and I don't even get an acknowledgement. I'm thinking, gee, you better do a reality check here, John. So,
yeah.
So
no,
that's why it's kind of nice for me to have an opportunity to speak with you and hear these things and say, no, these people are right. There's enough. I don't like to call it proof. There's enough evidence around, which is
right.
Very, very compelling, that we really compelling. Should be taking this subject more seriously than we are.
Well, so then, okay, well, let's take a step further. You would agree that the amateur researchers are probably the ones that are going to make, well, they will, because science hasn't recognized
definitely.
This effort. These are the guys and gals that are going to make these discoveries. So you've got people listening. They're saying to themselves, okay, what do I do? What's the most effective way to research? How is it done? Dr. Bindernagel, you have an audience. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, you know, I see, and this is what I'm going through with those poor folks up there in Alert Bay saying, gee, if it's vocalizations, they sort of need to be recorded so we can examine them. If you see a track, it sort of needs to be photographed, and if you can get around to it, cast to add to our collection of evidence. You know, if you see these, you know, these strange structures of sticks and limbs in the woods that say, gee, that's not natural, and I don't think there's any other humans out here, and I wonder, could it be attributed to the Sasquatch? Well, photographs are good, and one day we'll pull all this together and we'll say, my goodness, we've been seeing signs of this mammal for so long. We've been told, sorry, I'll stop. That goes into my rant. But that's right. We just need to keep building that database of evidence, I think. And,
sure.
And this is what's so frustrating. It's still a gradual thing, you know, failing. You know, I mean, it's almost a no-brainer when there's a cadaver. But when there is that cadaver, or it might be DNA, whatever definitive proof is finally sort of accepted by my scientific colleagues, there will be this looking back.
Sure.
And that's when it would be good if people said, well, here's what I found, here's what I documented, and I took it to the Fish and Wildlife branch of my state or town or whatever, and this is what they told me.
I know, right?
I'm getting to the point I've been so deferential to my colleagues, biologists, saying, yeah, there's justification for skepticism, but it's gone beyond healthy skepticism to that, I can only be called closed-mindedness. And they need to be called. At some point, they need to be called on that. Someone's got to do it.
Yeah, well, think of the world we live in now, and I feel like these scientists are probably caught up in the same thing. Information, we are so connected to each other. Somebody's reputation in the field could be affected, and that information could get around. You've got the internet, you've got Twitter, you've got Facebook, you've got LinkedIn, you've got all these things. People are afraid because information travels quickly. The other part of that is I feel like our society is so attention deficit. Well, their attention span is so short that if there's no instant gratification, then you move along. And I wonder if that also affects the scientific community. These folks are scientists. They're trained to observe, and they're trained to come to conclusions based on a certain pattern of process to get to where they want to go. I feel like, until there's a body, it's not going to be relevant because nobody is going to take the time to really sit and think about it other than these amateurs that are out there. Now, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's an interesting comment because what's going on in this community where I've been working lately, you know, it's someone said, and see, I'm not a Facebook person, I'm not a social media person, but it is being said. Someone says on Facebook, gee, I heard it last night, it was really loud, and someone says, oh, did you? I heard it too, but I didn't know what it was. So we have a person, a really good eyewitness, Rod Alfred. He spoke on television to a reporter who came along. But by the time the reporter was leaving, he said, oh, gee, I don't think I should have done that. I think I'd like to retract my interview. But it went ahead in a very modified form. The reporter made him look very good. And now the fellow's in line at the bank and say, hey, you'd be interested in what I heard last night. This is where I was. This is what I heard. So people are opening up. It's becoming okay. But you see, for most folks, it's not yet okay to have heard a vocalization and say, gee, that may have been, you know, Bigfoot or Sasquatch. It's
sure.
not okay to say, I saw these tracks and, yeah, anyway. And
what's
gee,
your...
we've got to get over it. I just wish we would get over that.
I sense your frustration. I feel it too. So what? I always ask everyone this that's on my show, especially if they're biologists or in the scientific community, in some respect. Why don't we have a body at this point?
Well, you know, there have been a couple. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get into conspiracy theories, but in my second book, I talked about a young man in Manitoba who shot one by mistake. He thought it was his wounded moose. He thought he was dispatching a wounded moose, and darn if it didn't turn out to be a Sasquatch. But he left us with a great description, but he fled. This was back 1941. He said, you know, money was tight, it was out of season, and da-da-da-da-da-da, and I thought, you know, there was this human-like aspect to the thing, and I thought, oh, gee, I could be in serious trouble. So, no, that, I don't know if that, I don't know what would happen today. But, I mean, there was a type specimen lying on the ground, which he described for us, and, you know, mm-hmm. in pretty good detail, very interesting, but a lot of anatomical details. But,
really?
Yeah, but most hunters, I mean, and even this hunter, if he had seen it clearly, he would never have shot it. He would have said, oh, that's not a moose. But it was walking away from him with his head bent forward, so it looked from the back end, like the back end of a moose. And these things apparently do walk sometimes with their head very low in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
But a hunter, I mean, there's a number of reports where hunters have had them in their sights and said, oh, well, I kept using my scope because that gave me a good look, but no way was I going to pull the trigger on something that looked that human. You know, I was hunting deer,
okay.
I was hunting moose.
So now I have to ask this question because I know there's people listening going, get the details. So anatomically, what was explained to you?
Well, you see, and this is where I have to be careful. It was very ape-like. It was sounded like an upright ape. But, you know, I've really tried to back off because in the investigating community, to say that it's an upright ape is offensive to a lot of investigators who feel it. No, it's much more human-like. And I say, oh, why don't we just say primate? You know, it includes apes, humans, monkeys, and just leave it in this broad group for now. Eventually, there will be this type specimen, but even the division ape and human is not as bold a line as it used to be. I mean,
mm-hmm.
so that's problematic, and I've really tried not to be divisive, he saw things like the rounded jaw instead
sure.
of the sharp chin of the human. He saw the brow ridges, he saw the long arms, and, you know, stuff which really we tend to think of as ape-like rather than human-like.
But can you imagine, honestly, I'm a hunter, right? Not very good at it, but I like to do it. I can't imagine making a kill, walking up on it, looking down at it, and saying, oh, my, this looks human. Did I just choose something human? Oh, my. Like, what would you – and I wouldn't say, oh, my. Trust me. I have a lot more colorful language than that. But I just get chills thinking about it. Can you even imagine that?
Well, yeah, because I visited this guy several times, and we talked. He'd call me every 2 weeks because it bothered him for the rest of his – he died a few years ago, but it bothered him for the rest of his life. I mean, he called me. He said I should come and talk to him, which I did. And then I talked to him again, and he called me every 2 weeks saying, hey, are we getting any further? Have you got any news? Has this thing been shown? And he became a real nuisance because he went to the truck stop near his town and interviewed truckers. You know, he got a lot of good reports. But, I mean, a lot of these amateur investigators, they've seen a Sasquatch, and they can't let it go. They say, gee, I've seen something. It's not being addressed by science. Someone should be doing something about this. And they become quite dedicated. And the investigating community is, I would say, full of those people. And anyway.
No. I just, when you're talking to these people, you got to feel for them. But at the same time, it's almost this curiosity, so you have to kind of walk that fine line. It's when I interview somebody on air about their experience, I have to be careful because I have to ask the hard questions. Well, how do you know this? For sure this? But you have to ask it in a way that you don't make them feel like you think they're an idiot. The other half of you is fascinated by the whole story. So I guess my question to you now is my next question is, why do you think — that's kind of a softball, but I'll throw it up there anyway. Why do you think this community, so-called, is so full of people who would otherwise be, or maybe, deemed crazy? You have hoaxers, you have holistic people, you have all these people talk to Bigfoot and the whole nine yards. Why in this particular one thing and not in any other field out there?
Well, I think it must be a real bummer for someone to have seen a Sasquatch and say, I've just seen an animal that in most people's mind does not exist. Am I nuts or did I really see that?
Right.
And then in some cases they go forward and find tracks, so they know it was a track-leaving mammal. And they start seeking, gee, has anyone else experienced this? And so there's this community, you know, of people saying, and you know, we did this once in a documentary. We got four or five eyewitnesses together, and it was therapeutic. It was cathartic for some people. Gee, I didn't know there was anyone else who'd seen one of these. And this is what really bugs me. We're in this zone of ignorance that people don't know that this thing is seen, I won't say commonly, but much more frequently as a species, much more commonly than people realize. But it's not a valid observation like a black bear or elk or, you know.
But it
keeps people going. I mean, people, they're really bugged by it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, as you know.
So the population of Sasquatches, I mean, you can't put a number on it. There's 30,000 around the country. I would think the population per square mile, or however you would put it as a wildlife biologist, because I know we look at deer like that as hunters, like in certain zones. What would you guess at all?
I wouldn't, because I feel that would be speculative, and then people say, well, when it comes to Bigfoot, it's all speculation. No, it's not speculation, it's evidence-based, but when it comes to numbers, it would be. I mean, we don't do very well here in British Columbia for grizzly bears. I think the estimate for the province is somewhere between 3,000 and 13,000, which is a pretty big spread. It may have changed recently, but, you know, so... And with the Sasquatch, I mean, some people see one and report it. Other people see one and do not report it. They might report it to a wife or a spouse and be ridiculed, and that's it. They're not going to talk about it again. So it's really hard at present, which is another reason why it would be nice if we treated it more seriously, so people could say, come forward and say, gee, I hear so-and-so saw one down, you know, down the road at so-and-so. I saw one there myself just 2 years ago. You know,
sure.
But that's not happening, is it?
Well, no, I get your sense of urgency. It's a good thing. I can feel it. excuse me. I want to ask you, and I get a little personal here, but I think this part of the story too. I like to get to know people. What's your plan for when you can't go out in the woods anymore? How are you going to take what you know and what you've learned and pass it on to people who can utilize that?
My plan for when I can't get out anymore?
Yeah, because you mentioned it. You mentioned, you know, your age.
Oh, yeah. Well, gee, I don't know. I mean, I'm just going to keep beating the bushes. But, you know, that's not my main thing. Beating the bushes is not my main thing. It is actually educational. And the second book, you know, 7 years in the writing, came out in 2010. Written really for scientists, you know, quite readable, but it's been ignored. And I thought, okay, so writing books isn't working. I did a YouTube video and got it on there, and a few people have looked at that. And I don't know what to do. You see, I'm not a man of the times who's on Facebook saying, do this, do that, talk to so and so, talk to. But other people are, and they're doing really nice work, and that's so great. I think I keep telling them, John, just hang in, you know, just hang in, just be here, because when things come up and people are saying, what, did you know that Sasquatches do this? And I'm able to say, well, according to John Green's work, he has a report of this from, you know, the 1960s. According to so-and-so's work, we have that. And I guess I'm becoming that sort of person, saying, you know, we do have this really strong database of information. We know a lot about the Sasquatch. We are not surprised by a lot of the reports. On the other hand, some things are new, and that's great.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm not sure where I fit in anymore.
Listen, the fact that you admit that is light years ahead of a lot of people. You know, and I'm sure that's changed over the years. You think you know where you fit, then you don't, then you think you do. Give us if you don't mind. Let me take one step back real quick here. I'll ask you really quick. Do you think you're close to something? Do you think you're close to seeing something or finding something out?
Are we close? Is that what you said?
Yeah, are you close? Do you know enough now at this point?
Oh, no. No. To me, it's all very incremental. You know, if we get some really clear vocalizations. Okay, so my colleagues in Washington will help me out, David Ellis and Paul Graves, and they'll create these wonderful spectrograms, and they'll show that this vocalization is unlike anything else. It's not like a human trying to make that call. It's not like a bear, and they'll go to the Macaulay Library of Sounds at Cornell, and they'll do a really good job.
Right.
And it'll just be as good as the collection of casts in Jeff Meldrum's lab. Pardon me for being cynical. And what good has that do if Jeff Meldrum can't get his colleagues from down the hall to come and look at his material? Well, at least at last conversation. So, but that's okay. Well, I'm not saying it's okay. But our responsibility, I feel, those of us who've been given the benefit of an education in science, is to bring the evidence. One day it will be acknowledged. One day people will look back and say, my goodness, they knew this as long ago as whatever.
Sure.
And you know, acknowledgments of scientific discovery are posthumous. The people involved, you know, they may have gone nuts during their life, and then they died, and then 15 years later they say, oh, you know, so-and-so was really on the right track. Yeah, well,
right.
I'm trying to become reconciled to that.
Right.
which is not a great situation, but anyway.
It's great to be vindicated, you know, it's great to be recognized, but, you know, unfortunately sometimes it happens, you know, late.
Oh, yeah, it's very common in science, actually.
Yeah.
And that's where, you see, in my second book I get into what they call philosophy of science, which sounds dry as bones, but it's about discoveries that took a long time to be acknowledged. And a prolonged discovery process is not unusual, except that this one is really prolonged. And I would say unnecessarily prolonged. We didn't have to. We don't have to be still tiptoeing around it the way we are. We could be saying, gee whiz, the evidence is sufficient to at least, deploy some of our state and provincial wildlife biologists to study this, and
sure,
not just keep putting off the people who report them. But so see, there again, I.
That's okay. No. Listen, you got to go back to what you're passionate about. And right now, I sense you want to stand on the soapbox and shout to the world. And listen, I don't blame you. You got a forum right now. Do it. You're among friends. Trust me. The people in the chat.
I understand that, and I appreciate that, because without conversations like you and I are having, I could get very depressed.
Yeah,
very depressed.
I imagine. But let me ask you about the current vocalizations that you're talking about, and then I want you to talk about your books that you've written, because I think it's only fair to give you your due on air, so that people can search out your work. And I'll tell you, we should talk offline, because I have some suggestions that social media can help you with and kind of expand and lengthen the study that you're doing. I've just become turned on to it myself, but I always like to talk to people about it. But what are the vocalizations that you're getting right now? What
yes.
How would you compare those to other vocalizations that you would, I don't say believe, suspect might be Sasquatch? Are these different, or are they kind of the same, or?
Well, this is what I'm getting from the investigators who are working with the spectrogram, just saying, here's the similarities. I mean, we're just dealing with a fellow in that community who is smart enough or willing to turn on his cell phone and get a recording. It's not the greatest recording, but it's pretty good. And they're saying, okay, here's the similarity. And there are a lot of these vocalizations that have been recorded, and I didn't know that. And I'm thinking,
sure,
gee, someone should pull this together, because there's a lot of evidence for this.
Sure.
And this is just the most recent. Yeah. So there's all these similarities, and they say, oh, it's in this Hertz range, and it's very compact. And here's a human trying to imitate it and see how different it is. Well, this is all new to me and very technical to me. So I'm on this very steep learning curve right now.
Yeah, but you'll get there quickly, because you have the mind for it. And when you start seeing the spectrograph,
thanks for that.
when you start, no, you do. So when you start, when you're very objective, right? So when you start seeing the spectrograph and how vocalizations line up with known patterns within that spectrograph of other vocalizations for other mammals, you'll very quickly deduce that, okay, this matches nothing on Vancouver Island, nothing. So I don't know what it is, but it doesn't match anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So.
And I think it's important that we do show the vocalizations of cougars and wolves and loons and owls, just to show people. So, but this is this becomes a whole sort of chapter in a book, or even a book. And as you mentioned earlier, people don't want all that information. They just want to say, is this Bigfoot or not? Well,
right.
I push my opinions on. I say, well, you listen to what bears can do, and bears can do some pretty amazing vocalizations.
Sure.
You listen to wolves and coyotes. You listen to this, and then listen to this, and then see. You're almost asking the public to become educated in spectrograms, like I am, saying, and explain them that this is what's being shown, and. That's a tough call. I mean, it's a tough call with the scientific colleagues. And what I'm learning is that the bioacoustics is a very large field in wildlife research these days. And it turns out I've got colleagues here in BC that I didn't know about working on this. So I'm quite excited, because there's help available. They may not like what I'm claiming these sounds are of, but they're coming on side with technical assistance. So that's great.
Sure. So, okay, I want you, if you could, feel free. I want you to talk about the books you've written. People will go search them out. They'll buy them. Give us just the litany of literary work that you have, and kind of what each book represents. And, I mean, we're going to have to wrap the interview up in about 10 minutes, but I want to give you some time to talk about that.
Yeah, well, thanks. I think I mentioned a bit earlier that I did my first book in 1988, and I was really quite pleased because I thought, gee, I pulled a lot of stuff together here about the anatomy and behavior and a bit of the ecology of the Sasquatch. And when you pull it together, it makes sense. And
sure.
That book was ignored. So the
and
second
what
book
the
I
title?
Got
what
into
was
this,
the title?
That's when I decided, okay, John, you're talking about a mammal that's not yet
sure.
considered to have been discovered. And then I got into, the discovery process. And that was fascinating because I started understanding, think of the platypus
mm-hmm.
from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
A skin was sent to a museum in North America. I think it was American Museum of Natural History. They said, oh, someone's is a hoax. Someone's playing a joke on us. Here's the duck. Here's the bill of a duck on the skin of
right.
a mammal.
Right.
Turned out to be a real mammal. And it's that kind of thing. And that's what we're going through now. My colleagues say, yeah, we've been through this before. There was Piltdown Man. Remember that? Someone
right.
had the human skull with the jaw of an orangutan, I think it was, and for 40 years that was accepted. And then they were, anthropologists were extremely embarrassed. They go, oh my goodness, this was a fairly well-designed hoax, and people got caught out. So now they're on guard. They're pretty sensitive. Now here we come along again saying, we got this new ape man, walks like a human, looks a bit like a gorilla, da-da.
Right.
We call it Bigfoot. There's another problem. We've given it a nickname, and not a
right.
very good nickname.
Well, that's the thing, too. It doesn't give credibility to the field, right? Bigfoot.
It doesn't, yeah. So I just think, I've had to back off and understand the reasons for scientific resistance. And
sure.
I am somewhat sympathetic with the healthy skepticism of my scientific colleagues.
Sure.
I'm just not accepting of the long-term resistance in the face of all this emerging evidence.
I think you're absolutely right, and I'm not a scientist, and I love the fact that in this interview, a couple of times I went down a road of conjecture, and by training and by instinct, because of who you are in your training, you just didn't follow me down that road. And I wasn't testing you, it was just me being me. But I love the fact that, you call it like you see it, and if there's evidence, there's evidence. If there's not, there's not. But you don't try to connect the dots when they can't be connected. But I want to tell you one thing, and then we got to get going because I'm up against the clock here. Well, first of all, would you ever consider coming back on and talking with us?
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
I actually need conversations like you and I are having to – You challenge me, and I like that. And
yeah.
I need to crystallize my thinking.
Sure. No, believe me, we appreciate it. I know the audience is going to really enjoy this interview a lot. I want to leave you with this, though, because I sense the fact that you're frustrated. I sense the fact that there's a sense of urgency. You've been researching a long time. A lot of people respect you more than you know. Believe me, if you're not on social media, you have no idea.
Well, thank you.
But I have heard from well-known entertainers, radio shows, TV commentators, whatever, when the topic of Bigfoot is on their show, ratings go up. And I love it because that means people just have an eye out and they're just kind of looking to see, hey, what is this all about? What is this all about? And I think that gets more amateur researchers out there. It gets more people in the woods. Eventually something's going to happen. So I'm saying don't lose heart.
Yeah.
Well,
Yeah. I mean, I think there's times when we maybe haven't presented ourselves as well as we might have. I'm referring now to finding Bigfoot. My two
sure.
good friends and good investigators, Bobo Fay and Cliff Erickman, and Bobo, love him, but,
yeah.
gee whiz, he doesn't endear himself to my scientific colleagues with his comments sometimes, but I mean,
yeah.
that's what's happened. It's almost like the subject has been kind of co-opted as a subject of entertainment.
Such
and I know the pressures when one is being interviewed for a documentary, and I've said things I would sure like to have withdrawn, yeah.
Sure, absolutely. Well, yeah, you're under pressure. You want to say the right thing to advance the cause. You want to say the right thing. you know, you want to have the credibility with your scientific colleagues, but also come across to somebody who's new to the subject as you want to give them enough to keep them interested, but you want to maintain your credibility. Absolutely, I agree 100%. So, let's do this. I've got to get going. But Dr. Bindernagel, I really, really appreciate your time, and you know, I found this great.
Thank you, David. I've enjoyed this very much.
Absolutely. All right, so, well, that'll do it for the interview with Dr. Bindernagel. Dr. Bindernagel, we'll look forward to having you on another time. And if you didn't have anything else, I think we're pretty much done here.
Thanks very much.
All righty, sir. Over and out.